This podcast is proudly supported by Red Energy. Most satisfied customers 11 years in a row. Maybe it's time you called Red Energy on 131 806. And Prince Wine Store, bringing wine enthusiasts the greatest wine in the world.
Love him or hate him, he's very consistent. Like, he never changes his mood or his style.
He was angry yesterday. I don't think I've ever heard the Premier swear, saying these are shitty choices.
He's just kicked the can down the road again. They have delayed this issue for years. From the time Gillon McLachlan took over, they have just put Tasmania in the too hard basket.
I was outraged. It's like a white fella overlay on a wonderful Indigenous heritage. Nut caro, not into it. Really cross, and come on Ballarat people, come on Ballarat family, get those placards happening. March the streets.
What I would give to be on Martha's Vineyard at the moment.
Carol, I'm hanging out for Port Fairy.
Yeah, well, that...
I don't care where I go, just get me out of lockdown Melbourne.
He could be grumpy, he was old-fashioned in his humour. There are not many broadcasters like Ernie anymore. He was really the little Aussie battler.
Don't Shoot the Messenger podcast with Caroline Wilson and Corey Perkin.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 185 of Don't Shoot the Messenger. Haven't I been saying that a lot this week? Corey Perkin, lovely to be with you again, although we wake up to the last days of winter, but a fairly frightening world. Melbourne is back in its most severe lockdown since the one of last winter that led into spring and went for weeks into months. And obviously the news on the other side of the world, Corey, is equally grim. But we do have Miss Jane and her beautiful pink camellias that we can see from a long way away. And there's lots to talk about.
There's so much to talk about. Hello, Caro. Hello, Miss Jane. Hello, potties in lockdown. Or like two of my children, not three, but two of them are not in lockdown because they live in regional Victoria. It's a very strange and confusing world, Caro.
It is. To be completely trivial, Corrie, Elizabeth Gayton agreed with my mother, Julia. The guest list, she felt, was an unrewarding read. We do owe Anna from the op shop an apology. A bit like you, Corrie, Anna actually did review this book last year on the podcast.
I did. Remember I said to you, haven't we done that?
Yeah.
That's my fault, though, Caro, because we must have done it in your absence.
I think that's right, Corrie.
I should have known.
But she really enjoyed it. I ended up finishing it. It was a complete page turner. Couldn't put it down. Then a third friend, Mary, confused matters by saying she'd seen it on TV. I've looked it up. She definitely hasn't seen it on TV, although they are making a TV show of Lucy Foley's other bestseller, The Hunting Party. So who knows, Corrie, who knows?
Well, there was a bit of confusion also on one comment on Instagram. Caro from Juliana Claridge 1 said, is the Nancy Mitford screen adaptation a go-to-the-movies event or streaming? Well, Juliana, if you can get to the movies, good luck to you. The Pursuit of Love is not on at the movies. It is on via Amazon Prime, which I have never joined before, Caro, but I did to watch this particular series. And I'm very happy with Amazon Prime, I have to say. It's my little luxury this lockdown.
Oh, look, it's absolutely... And, Corrie, go for it. Seriously, there's not a huge amount of things to do. Their choices are absolutely brilliant. I just wanted to say hello to my old friend Thea Guest, who is our London messenger. She got in touch, Corrie, with both of us to say how much she's enjoying the podcast. What Thea doesn't do, she's a journalist. She used to be a gun journo on Panorama. She's become a magistrate and now she's volunteering with St John's Ambulance and delivering vaccines. She's not hugely complimentary of Boris. I won't say what she called him, but she did say the fact that he put a woman in charge of the vaccine program has meant that the UK is doing very well in that area. And she's also got puppy issues. She's got some great book recommendations. She can't understand why we talk so much about the royal family because none of her set do over in England, but I guess that's just the way we roll, Corrie.
No, it was a great letter from Thea and sending lots of love, and I hope everyone over there is having a lovely summer.
Now, speaking of seasons, and I've got a seasonal recipe later on, what are the first signs of spring for you? Because sitting here today, it's fairly grey where I am.
It's pretty grey, Caro. It's pretty grey where I am sitting as well. It's just another wave of rain has come through. My intrepid husband, who is trying for health reasons to walk at least 10,000 steps a day, went off about 15 minutes ago. He doesn't have an umbrella, so there you go. Bad luck. Drowned rat. But the first sign, of course, is hay fever in this house. There's lots of wattle popping out, which is beautiful to see. But there's been a bit of hay fever happening in the last week, so I guess that's probably the first sign. And as I said last week, it's a bit lighter in the mornings.
It is. And there's also that... I don't really like the first spring blossom. It's that pink one that goes to the dark red leaves that isn't particularly rewarding except for a couple of weeks. I like to wait for the later blossoms, the white particularly. But there's blossom everywhere. And all those bulbs I planted back in at Easter, I reckon, before I rushed off to Amsterdam, are all coming up. And I've got all these beautiful early chia and jonquil and double daffodils, and I've completely forgotten what I planted and where. So that's been a really lovely surprise. Every day I go outside and find another one. So, and I did get stuck into the herb garden on Sunday. I just spent 2 hours outside, just cleaned out every pot, replanted everything, did a click and collect at my local garden nursery. So I'm feeling like we're trying to force spring, even if we can't see it, Corrie.
Yeah, it's good. It's good to have the intention, Caro, but got to tell you, it's pretty bloody cold here today where I am. Anyway, we'll be positive and hope the sun shines soon.
Well, as we sit here today, in my world, Melbourne and the state of Victoria are still not giving up on hosting the grand final, but it's looking less and less likely. We're not going to have any footy finals in Victoria for the first week or the second week of the finals because the AFL won't hold them without crowds. This is 24 hours after the Premier, Daniel Andrews, announced a really, really grim lockdown. He seemed at tipping point, I thought, in that press conference yesterday. He seemed angry. One thing about Daniel Andrews, love him or hate him, he's very consistent, isn't he? Like, he never changes his mood or his style.
Well, he was angry yesterday. I don't think I've ever heard the Premier swear, saying these are shitty choices, when he was talking about the East St Kilda...
engagement party.
Possible super spreader engagement
party. Two doctors were at that party. Two doctors.
Caro, you just, honestly, you can't get me started on this one. Look, I understand the language and cultural challenges with multicultural groups, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne's western suburbs. I really understand the concerns of the community leaders there in getting through what has been happening, particularly last year, Caro, if you remember, during Melbourne's two lockdowns. There was a lot of discussion about how to penetrate those communities and get the right information out there. But this was a group who knew the rules. As you said, a couple of health workers, as we understand, were there. What were they thinking? They knew the rules because the groom-to-be actually made fun of the rules.
I don't know the backstory of who actually filmed this and who leaked it.
Well, isn't it interesting? Because I imagine what's happened is that an innocent has filmed it as a bit of, you know, isn't this fun and jolly? And all engagement parties are wonderful. There's no denying that. They're a wonderful moment for two families and friends to come together and celebrate a young couple's love. But somebody has obviously passed it on to somebody, I reckon, saying, oh, isn't this great? They celebrated the other night. And then, of course, somehow it's infiltrated. And at some point, somebody has been a whistleblower. Good on them. And as I understand, the police then picked it up. I'm not sure whether it was sent to them directly or they'd heard about it. But the video then ended up in the hands of the police, who are now, as we speak, enforcing $5,500 fines on everyone who attended except the children. But it is a really...
A second positive case came out of it when I last read yesterday as well.
Isn't that the annoying end result of this, Caro? I mean, not only are we in lockdown and curfew, which it just really does my head in, the fact that not that I'm out a lot at 9 o'clock at night, but just being told you can't go out at night is very confronting. But the fact that there are now going to be sick people within this group, which we don't want, and how long have they all been infected and where have they been?
Yeah, and look, I was in Melbourne over the weekend, obviously, post-work at 3AW. There were people everywhere. It was a beautiful weekend. Finally, the sun came out. The queues outside the bakeries, the coffee shops. I think, around the tan was just like a massive cocktail party. It was to be avoided at all costs. Inside the Botanic Gardens wasn't so bad. And, you know, you want those places to stay open. So I really, really hope that people start behaving themselves. The curfew to me is a psychological thing. It's a way of just telling people you really have to take this seriously. Please do it for 2 weeks, and maybe we'll get ahead of this, because some people don't like the fact that the Premier keeps talking about Sydney, but Sydney seems to change their policy every day. Like, there is no consistency, and there's certainly no real lockdown compared to what we do in terms of outdoor sport and stuff.
And from a national level too, where's the federal government? I continue to remain underwhelmed by Greg Hunt's contribution at the moment. Really, there should be something coming, some sort of national perspective as well. But you're right about Sydney, Caro. It does seem to be curious and confusing. I kind of enjoy the way, if that's the right word, the way the Victorian team are so kind of they believe in the anecdote, okay, which as you and I know as journos, as storytellers, a really good way into a story to break down an important and difficult issue for people is to use the anecdote. So the anecdote of all these people congregating outside bars and standing there and having glasses of alcohol, which of course becomes a party, compared to those who might buy a coffee and move on. So now we're not allowed to drink alcohol outside, we've got to keep a mask on, which means, okay, all those little champagne bars that we've been seeing popping up, all of the bars around Richmond that offended on the weekend, no more sipping alcohol, everyone, but you can still have your coffee.
Yep.
But you're not allowed to stand outside the cafe, but you can keep moving with your mask down and drink your coffee.
Well, we are Melbourne after all, Corrie. We are.
And there was another line too, Cara, I read this morning, where they said if you go down to the fish and chip shop to pick up your fish and chips, you might be allowed on the way home, if you're walking alone, to take your mask down to eat one hot chip. And I thought, every Victorian gets that. We understand.
It's a bit hard. It's a bit what hard to look is at hot chips, isn't it? You can't just look at them. You cannot.
But exactly right. And so they're kind of addressing it at a level that I think people understand. And I think their comms has been pretty good, although I am just not happy with lockdown, Caro. And I've realised how lucky I was to be working at the bookshop, to have a meaningful job, because we felt it was pretty meaningful to be delivering books to people's doors. But now, without that, as we talked about last week, without that routine of work, it's a very different lockdown.
Yeah, it was pretty grim from my side yesterday. Not only was I offered security help down to the car park after filming Footy Classified because of the 60 Minutes story, that very frightening Nick McKenzie story about neo-Nazis infiltrating Victoria, just terrifying and so upsetting. And then, so you get into the car. I had Craig Hutchison as my great protector.
Superman.
I know. And then you drive home and there is just no one out on the roads. No one. It was quiet. It was grim. And that's the next 2 weeks, and let's hope that all it is. Now, Corrie, on a cheery note, we do have something to so look forward to now every weekend. The Newsreader. How good was it?
Well, in fact, Sunday night on the ABC, once again, welcome back,
Cotter.
It's great. So we'll talk about the other, I think we're going to have a chat about that in BSF, the first show that we loved, 7:30. But at 8:30, yeah, we've got The Newsreader, which is a six-part series, Sunday nights, 8:30. Very good cast. And, Caro, I was interested to see it's directed by Emma Freeman, as opposed to Emma Friedman, who pops up at the racing carnival time. But Emma Freeman, who is that wonderful young director who, remember last year, Stateless?
Yes, that was a brilliant show.
She won a Best Director for that too. I think she's such a major talent. What do you think of The Newsreader?
Well, I think it's so significant that they've set it in the 80s, because there was no better time. Look, you and I weren't working in newsrooms in the 60s or the 70s. Well, I became a copy girl in 1978 as a 17-year-old. But the 80s were, you know, our era, our time. But it was just a lot of fun. There were still newspapers and TV stations were still spending lots of money. They were travelling. They were employing lots of people. And this, I mean, I still remember where I was. And the first episode deals with the space shuttle explosion. And I was working in, I was standing in my London bureau watching that rocket take off. And I remember Krista, I remember her family, you know, and I remember Halley's Comet and, you know, Paul Hogan and all the stories that they're covering in that first episode are so our era. I do remember I had a sports editor once, Steve Linnell, when I first became chief footy writer. And he said, you guys, you're also 80s. You know, you all live in the past. And I probably do. So I've actually absolutely loved this series because it's so my time. The sportscaster is so perfect, isn't he? He's so perfect.
And when he sort of bails out of the, I can't do this, I'm only a sports reporter, when they say the challenges has exploded, we need to go to air, you need to be the anchor at this moment. And he's at first he's flattered and thinks yes, and then as he's watching the footage in the editing booth, he says, I can't do this. I'm just a sports reporter.
Yeah, well, that bit I don't quite believe. But William McGuinness, I love. Look, he is the world's greatest over-actor and he's completely hamming this one up. But he does seem pretty perfect in the role, doesn't he?
Tell me he has a bodysuit on.
Oh, no, I think that's what he looks like.
He has not put on that much. You mean the man from Sea Change, the hunk, the pin-up, has put on that much weight?
Corrie, come
surely
on.
Surely not.
It's easy to make people look big for TV. I mean, I think that, anyway, I think he's perfectly cast. I love all the characters, really. Marg Downey, our friend, our Scrabble buddy, who disappeared for most of the summer from our Scrabble boards, saying she was making a TV series. Well, we now know, we're now watching the fruits of her labour. And remember she told us that the house, because she plays the wife of Robert Taylor, who is the ageing anchorman who doesn't want to...
loosely based on Brian Henderson, I thought. Remember back in the... Oh, you might not remember, but
who
back
died
in the
recently,
80s,
yep.
That's right, he died a couple of weeks ago. Well, last week. Brian Henderson, there was a bit of argy-bargy in the 80s because they talked about, or maybe it was the early 90s, about bringing on a female co-anchor to go with Brian on the Channel 9 news in Sydney, and he was dead against it. So I had a feeling there was a little bit of Brian Henderson in this character.
And it happened with David Johnson or Mal Walden, didn't it, too, at Channel 10. Yeah, he's fantastic. And Marg Downey is sort of the power behind the throne. She's had rave reviews. I can't remember a bad review for anything Marg's ever done, but she's had rave reviews for this one.
And she's great as the Machiavellian wife.
Well, it's sort of spot the Melbourne landmark, isn't it? Because she explained that they filmed her scenes in a house that was, I think, being sold or was vacant for the summer, a house around Camberwell or Hawthorne. And then the house where the young aspiring journo lives, or the apartment, I think that is in sort of on the other side of Dandenong Road in sort of Caulfield or East St Kilda, around Hughenden Road, one of those roads.
But it's interesting, Caro. Unlike a lot of dramas that have been set in Melbourne, I was just, the name has escaped me. The one that where Geoffrey Rush played allegedly our good friend Bruce Guthrie. Bruce always liked to think that. What was that? Well, that was set in the newspaper office.
Yeah, was that called the paper, the Sunday paper?
Yeah. It'll come to me in a minute, but there were lots of. You had a very strong sense of a Melbourne paper and a Melbourne view of newspaper wars and so on in that show. I have a feeling that this could be more, it's more general. I don't necessarily feel it's a particularly Melbourne scenario, this. One thing
no, it's
that
just
I
that
thought,
we like things, we like Melbourne.
That's what we do. No, yeah, spot the street corner. But, Cara, one thing I thought was not the 80s that I remember, at least at the Age newsroom where I worked for most of the 80s, is the diversity. The cultural diversity among the staff, seriously, back in the late 70s, early 80s, when I started in newspapers, there were not a lot of people that were not part of the white bread sandwich script, really.
Oh, I remember at the Herald, we had the Melbourne Herald. By the way, the show you're talking about is Mercury, Miss Jane's just reminded
us.
That's
right, thank you.
That was the name of the paper.
Jane.
Well, you know, obviously there was, we had a lot of Indian and Sri Lankan sub-editors. We had quite a few, certainly not Asian-born, but Asian heritage journos. No, I thought we had a, we were more culturally diverse at the old Melbourne Herald, believe it or not. Although there were a lot of Melbourne private and big Catholic school people who got cadetships.
It did make me think, Caro, of some of the, and Jane, thank you mentioning the Mercury, which I loved. But of all the great TV shows and the films that we've seen that have centred around newsrooms, or newsrooms have really been the kind of the chief bolt hole for the action. Of course, All the President's Men in 1976, which was just the fabulous Robert Redford, Dustin Hoffman performance, reliving the Watergate scandal.
Well, let's face it, anything involving Catherine Graham, including that brilliant film we saw.
With Tom Hanks, yes. But then more locally, do you remember Paper Giants a few years ago?
Fantastic.
The Dulcie Bowling, Nene yep. King rivalry. Wasn't that fantastic? There have been quite a few, and I do find them just totally riveting.
My favourite, one of my favourites was The Paper with Michael Keaton, and that had a great cast. It had Robert Duvall, Marissa Tomei, Glenn Close.
Oh, that's
Jason
the one
Robards.
Where they. That's the one where they expose the Catholic Church for crimes.
That's the one set in Boston. This is a sort of a comedy drama. Randy Newman sang the title song. Make up your mind. Anyway, it's called The Paper. It was a Ron Howard film. Corrie, honestly, anyone, look it up. Find it on, it'll be on something. It might even be on Netflix. It is one of the most realistic portrayals of newspaper life. It is absolutely brilliant.
The other thing I did love too is the set, because that, it just reminded me so much of the old age building in Spencer Street, which when that building was first built in 1969 with all its faux timber panelling, small offices and big wide desks for sub-editors and gold carpet, everybody said, oh, it's such a state-of-the-art building. And actually looking at that similar kind of setting on Sunday night through this television show, I thought, nah, it was never a good look.
I agree the set is brilliant. And Miss Jane, what can't she do? You can watch The Paper. And Corrie, you should do this because it's on Amazon Prime. Another reason that you've signed up.
Another reason.
It is really funny, but it's also really serious. Just like this one is. I mean, The Newsroom is, is it called The Newsroom? No, The Newsroom is the other.
The Newsroom is the one we love with Emily Mortimer and
absolutely brilliant.
Yes, sensational.
Absolutely brilliant film, but a brilliant series, which I just loved. And Jane Fonda, of course, plays the crotchety owner who keeps turning up every few episodes.
Yeah, and written by Aaron Sorkin. In fact, Caro, that's a really good tip. Jeff Daniels plays the main character, and Emily Mortimer is the producer of this nightly show. It's a great one for lockdown if people haven't caught it. What is it, about 5 years old maybe, but still relevant, still fabulous.
I love they had the red team where they ran, you know, risky stories past them, which is something that I can completely relate to. But one more thing about this show is the ABC Sunday night one, and you can't watch it all in one go, can you? We've got to, you can't go on iView and watch it all.
No.
Is that although it's got some really funny moments, it's also got some really serious moments. And, you know, the way William McGuinness speaks to the main female character is just so disgusting. And yet it's sort of funny because that's what happened all the time, telling her, you know, about, calls her ugly and, you know, she's her own war zone and all that sort of stuff. And then she, of course, in the first episode, takes an overdose, and that's sort of the basis for the relationship between her and the young aspiring journo.
They're kind of rescuing one another, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
And even though he comes across initially as a rather bumbling sort of chap, young reporter who played brilliantly by Sam Reed, I might say, but as Dale, the young reporter, ringing home to his mother saying, "Mum, you know, I might be able to read the morning news. I think they've said I can do it next week.
The updates.
And she goes, the updates, that's right. And she says, can I tell everyone? And he goes, yes, you can. So, of course, news around the burbs. Young Dale's going to be on television next week. And he fluffs it. I mean, who hasn't really? Even I was thinking about this as I was watching it, squirming in his embarrassment, thinking, look, he would be better prepared than that. But I do remember having a chat with Laura Tingle, who told me that when she first transitioned from print media onto 7:30 on the ABC, now she's just a gun at it, but she said the first couple of crosses from Lee Sales to her in Canberra, she was so nervous she couldn't get the words out. Her mouth was contorted almost. And it must be such a shock, no matter what kind of a news pro you are.
Corrie, that, as I said, it's a brilliant Sunday night viewing, and we're going to talk about what precedes it in a moment in BSF. But you are going to open up the cocktail cabinet.
I am going to open up the cocktail cabinet with our friend Miles Thompson. And thank you again, Prince Wine Store. Prince Wine Store and Red Energy are the two supporters of our little podcast. We love you guys to bits. And Prince Wine Store, of course, bringing Melburnians the greatest wine in the world. And you can visit their terrific website, from which I am frequently ordering, I have to say, princewinestore.com.au.
More often than usual.
A little more often than usual. Well, it's funny, you know, in lockdown, wine tasting has become a bit of a thing. We're trying to do it in moderation, but we will have a little wine tasting, sometimes amongst the family members, sometimes just Pete and I, trying not to knock off a whole bottle. But yes, Prince Wine Store have been very valuable in this particular instance, and I think, Jane, it might be time to bring along the cocktail cabinet. And thank you, Jane. Jane is pouring drinks, and Miles Thompson is here from the Prince Wine Store. And what are we drinking today, Miles?
Oh, I've got a little Tuscan double today, so from a producer called Fontaleone, and it's a fantastic little Chianti and Vernaccia di San Gimignano.
Oh, how beautiful. So we've been travelling to Tuscany a bit in the last few weeks. There's been a lot of discussion in my life anyway about this beautiful book, Still Life, which is set in Florence. I can absolutely picture the little villages of where we might be. Tell me about the Chianti.
Yeah, so this is a brother and sister team, Matteo and Simona. They have a consultant on called Paul Cassiagiona. I probably haven't said that right. They make such wonderful wine. They're sort of new to sort of Prince Wine Store, but their Chianti is this lovely, very fresh, crunchy, really bright style Chianti. Not on the sort of richer side, much more on the sort of lighter, fresher style. Has that lovely, beautiful sort of sour cherry fruit that you get from Sangiovese and those lovely sort of crunchy tannins and fresh sort of acidity, which makes it really perfect for as a food wine. And $25, they're just such stunning value.
That is an amazing price, Miles, for an import. That's incredible.
It's really good. I didn't get to go, but the team were over there a few years ago, and you know, they went and saw the vineyards, and they're actually based in San Gimignano, where they make the Vernaccia, which is such a beautiful little town. But everyone was super, super impressed. You know, they're trying to sort of do organics in the vineyards. They don't use any herbicides. They're really sort of pushing the quality rather than quantity, which you often see out of the region there. And they're just doing such a wonderful job. We really love their wine.
Well, well done, Matteo and Simona, for the Pontaleone Chianti. I do love the idea of it being a bit lighter and brighter. Sometimes Chiantis can be quite heavy.
Yeah, exactly. And this is really modern, really fresh. And yeah, it's such a, you know, like you could have it with like charcuterie or, you know, chicken, you know, like roast chicken or something like that. It's sort of, it's definitely light enough to do that. You can have it with pork, really sort of makes it really versatile. And you can have it on its own, which is really nice too.
Great. So that's $25 a bottle. And what is the second Tuscan wine?
So same again from Fontaleone. And it's their Vernaccia di San Gimignano. So Vernaccia is a really lovely sort of kind of neutral sort of grape, but it has a lovely sort of green tree fruit, a little bit of this kind of what they call this sort of almond, sort of bitter almond skin, which gives it a nice little sort of texture and a little hit on the palate, which again makes it really perfect for or food, and it has this little sort of slight anise sort of hint to it as well. Very fresh, very bright, no oak, super easy drinking, just, again, super, super little wine.
And what's the vineyard called again, Miles?
So Fontaglione.
Right.
Is the vineyard, yeah, yeah. And so they make the Vernaccia di San Gimignano and the Chianti.
And tell me what the price is of the Fontaglione, that second bottle.
Vernaccia?
Yeah.
Yeah, so $25 each for both of them. So absolute, like, we're kind of floored every time we open one of them at the quality. They're just really that good.
That is great. They sound like beautiful winter wines too, because August being such a cold month in Melbourne, they sound absolutely perfect, Miles.
Oh, perfect. No, they're so good. I take them home, I'd say, once a month. One of them comes home with me from the shop, definitely.
God, I don't know how you contain yourself to just one. I'd be taking, as I keep discussing, the boxes from Prince Wine Store just keep arriving at my house. And Miles, that is why we love our connection with Prince Wine Store, not because I can keep my grog habit going up, but because it is so convenient, as we know. And obviously, as always, you guys are offering very kindly to our messengers a discount.
Yeah, so 10% off when you put in the code MESS at the checkout, and you'll get 10% off those wines. So makes them even better value.
Fantastic. And then in the next couple of weeks, we'll be looking at some Father's Day gift ideas in the alcohol department. So I can't wait to have a chat with you about those.
Yeah, I've got a few little ideas, some fun stuff, hopefully some interesting things.
Great. Thank you, Miles. Thank you very much to Prince Wine Store for your wonderful support. And as Miles said, use the promo code MESS at the checkout online to receive our listener discount. Thanks, Miles.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Corrie. Thank you, Miles. And now for Red Energy, 100% Australian electricity and gas. Corrie has a crush.
I have a big crush on a big topic here, Caro. It's the men who nurtured basketball in Australia. It's basketball in Australia. It's our Olympic team who won bronze, their first ever Olympic medal after years of coming fourth. Gosh, did we never? I don't know whether we ever thought, Caro, they'd be able to win a medal, but they are all the catalysts for this crush. They really are. And it was particularly prompted also, and I know you saw this series too, Australian Story last week and the week before did a wonderful two-part series on Luke Longley, that giant of a young man who was an absolute gun from Perth, who went on to the US to play college football and then was picked up, of course, by the Chicago Bulls. And he played in the great Chicago Bulls teams of Michael Jordan and so on. But it's not just Luke Longley who are my crush. It's people like Lindsay Gaze. I don't know whether you saw Andrew Gaze paying tribute to his father so emotionally, Caro,
wasn't it
fabulous?
Well, Paddy Mills is my hero at the moment. And not only has he led this team, and that fine, or that, well, it was a playoff, wasn't it, for the bronze medal. He pushed Australia over the line. His scoring, his leadership. He carried the flag. I think he's the first Indigenous Australian to carry the flag into an Olympic ceremony for Australia. The work he does for Indigenous Australians back here in Australia, the work he's done overseas, he is just one of our great ambassadors and will continue to be so. And, yeah, that Luke Longley story was, you know, how long it took him to get over being left out of The Last Dance, the Michael Jordan film. It was awful. I mean, it was so sad. And Andrew Webster actually wrote a great column about it in the in Nine Media, The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald, which is worth looking up. And I think it was like 8 months before he could sort of communicate with anyone publicly about it.
He was shattered, but there's a nice resolution at the end, which we won't say, just in case people want to pick it up on iView. You can see Australian Story on iView, and that's the two-part doco on Luke Longley. It's brilliant. But, Caro, I can remember as a young sports reporter back in 1981, one of the very first, it was a picture story, and I was sent out to a basketball stadium somewhere around the Essendon area. And I think the National Basketball League was only a couple of years old at that stage. But the enthusiasm of the team and the coaches talking to me about how this sport was going to take off in Australia, me as a young, what was I then, 20 or 21-year-old, was a bit sceptical, I have to say. I wasn't sure. But, wow, how far it's come. And so that is my massive crush, massive topic, a lot of people involved, but well done, everybody, for growing that sport in Australia.
Long way to go, but they're certainly getting there. Now, Corrie, you're on a roll, so let's kick off BSF with a book.
So, Cara, we've been talking a lot about Still Life by Sarah Winman, a book that you and I have absolutely loved. A lot of my customers have, former customers have jumped on board with it. We had a lovely webinar event last week with Sarah Winman. It was a terrific success. And I thought that if people were really engaged and intrigued by one part of this story, which is Sarah's nod to the life of Henry James, it reminded me of a beautiful book I read a few years ago, which I found in the bookshelf again not so long ago. It's called The Master by Colm Tóibín. And Colm Tóibín is one of my favourite writers. He's an Irish writer. Many people would know him for the novel Brooklyn, which then became a movie. They might also know him for The Testament of Mary, Blackwater Lightship, quite a few books. Wonderful, beautiful, beautiful writer. And in this book, Colm Tóibín has dared, Caro, dared to write a fictional account of a section of Henry James's life. So he's put himself into the shoes of a great literary master. And boy, oh boy, has he pulled it off successfully. He looks at this particular four-year period of Henry James's life when Henry was in his 50s. He was living in England. He'd written a play for the London stage. It had bombed dramatically. And Henry James, who was a particularly tortured soul anyway, very kind of internal thinking, had never really understood his sexuality, had never embraced his homosexuality because that was never allowed. And he was so shattered by this terrible occurrence of this play being panned and taken off after only a couple of nights. He takes himself off to a lonely house in East Sussex, where for the next couple of years he writes furiously some of the best work of his, best fiction of his life. Some of the great novels come out of this period. And so Colm Tóibín takes us into this particular period, but there's a lot of back and forth. Caro, Henry James, his family was quite strict. They were very conservative, and of course into this conservative family emerges this highly artistic, rather in a way sensuous thinking person in Henry James. He was often very lonely as a child, and there is a terrific section where the American Civil War comes into this through family who fought in it. And then, of course, there's contemporary Henry, as we see, sitting in the small town of Ryan, East Sussex, reflecting on his life and his loneliness, his internal tussle with his own sexuality. And there, of course, is the trial and the scandal of Oscar Wilde looming forth. So it's a great novel, highly recommended if people who read Sarah Winman's book Still Life want to take the Henry James journey a little further.
That sounds like a great tip, Corrie. And before we move off books, Thea Guest, of course, who I just mentioned earlier in the show, she's loving our book recommendations, and particularly thank you for The Yield by Tara June Welch. But
Tara June Winch.
Winch, sorry. It's spelt wrongly in her email, and I knew
that.
I knew that, Thea. I knew that, Corrie. But she thanked Anna from the Op Shop, who recommended, remember, To Calais in Ordinary Time by James Meek? And she also recommends by James Meek, The People's Act of Love. Now, I've been hearing a lot about this author, so I just thought James Meek was another one we might have a look at in the coming
weeks.
That's
a very good idea. Very good idea.
Now, we can't travel. We can't go anywhere. We're dreaming of returning to Europe one day. And boy, is Joanna Lumley leading us on a merry dance every Sunday night on Channel 2, Corrie. That is our screen. Did you watch her visit to Scotland and the Outer Hebrides on Sunday night?
Yes, I did. Oh. I did. So I presume, Caro, she's doing this story, she's doing Britain because last year she couldn't travel anywhere. I'm assuming that's the case.
Well, I mean, either way, what a brilliant idea.
It's such a brilliant idea. And it's interesting because it's interesting for me because Joanna Lumley, having been born, she was born in India and she came to live in England, I think around the time of partition. So she was a young girl, but she's almost seeing Britain through a visitor's eyes. Yet there is the huge familiarity of places that she recalls as a child. Didn't you love her having the drink with the old Coronation Street?
Oh, yep. Oh.
Actor who all these years later, decades later, is still on Coronation Street.
I know. But the beauty and the rugged. I remember my mother years ago went on a boat trip around the Hebrides, Outer Hebrides. And I know Anna from the op shop, Sister Julie, had her wedding, had her honeymoon there. That part of the world just fascinates me. I think we have to put that back on the agenda, not worry about the midges and go there. But the good local tip, Corrie, the last episode, she ends up in Cornwall. So I'm pretty excited about that.
I had a feeling she might end up in Cornwall.
She goes
via,
I'm very
excited about that.
I think she does a bit of Somerset, a bit of Devon. I think there's a bit of Dartmoor. I think even Truro. So, I'm just absolutely loving this series and it's so beautifully filmed. What about George Orwell's house?
Yes, that isn't that just stunning where he wrote 1984? And, Caro, I didn't know, nearly died in a drowning accident with his three-year-old son, the boat capsized only to be rescued by a passing fisherman, which made me think, trying to keep a three-year-old out of the water for a long period of time, it must have been a very traumatic experience. How interesting.
And the house is still owned by the family and it's so remote and, it's absolutely beautiful.
The landscape was gorgeous. And I think you're right. I think we have to put Scotland firmly back on our walking agenda.
Joanna Lumley's Britain. And she does Wales. And, it's just wonderful. That's on. So you watch that at 7:30 after the news. And then you click over to the newsreader. Tickety-boo. Night's sorted.
Perfect night with a bit of Prince Wine, Store Wine.
And I've got the recipe to eat while you're watching
it. Okay, so what's your recipe? Tell me.
Well, I've tried to look up spring recipes because we're pretending that spring is in the air and it almost is. And Corrie, this is a recipe that I read about. It's one from a good friend of ours who is one of the best cooks I know, Deb Middleton. And she put this recipe in kids' school cookbook years and years ago. And I've cooked it several times. It is absolutely beautiful. It's a veal and porcini ragu. Now, you would love it because it's got lots of mushrooms in it and you're the mushroom queen. Deb's recipe serves six, which means if I'm just cooking for me and Brendan, I halve it because we eat enough for three people, two of us. She says the cooking time's an hour and preparation 30 minutes, and I reckon that's just about right. Corrie, this is absolutely beautiful, this ragu. It's she says, Deb, that she's just refined this over many, many years and she now thinks she's perfected it. It basically involves a kilo of diced veal, preferably rump, stalks of parsley, sage and rosemary, two star anise, that's the rogue ingredient, grated nutmeg, olive oil, onion, garlic, etc. And the mushrooms she uses are Swiss browns and dried porcini soaked in warm water for half an hour. Porcini powder, which you can buy, she buys from the Paran market, the essential ingredient, but you can find it elsewhere. And there's just the tomato paste, white wine, red wine, salt and pepper. Corrie, this is absolutely beautiful. Once you've got it all together, you throw it in the oven and cook it for an hour. And Deb recommends cooking it and maybe serving it the next day on, as I said, wet polenta. I've actually done it on pasta. I think it is. You can have it just on a bed of rocket or salad. It is absolutely beautiful.
Sounds great. There's something about mushrooms the next day. You know, Caro, last week we were talking about toppings to put on your steak and I had the mushroom recipe. Well, in fact, we'd made a huge batch of this mushroom topping. And so it sat in the fridge and I had two lots of pasta last week using the last of the mushrooms. I swear to God, every day it got better and better. I don't know whether the dietitians or health microbiologists would be saying to me, no, there's a bit too much fungi happening there in that bowl. But gosh, it really tasted great.
Well, most of the young guys I work with at Channel 9 will be horrified by the veal and porcini ragu because there are a lot of vegetarians beneath the age of 40, I'm finding. But this one, and they would love your mushroom recipe, but this, if you're a meat eater, is absolutely delicious. Now, that was BSF for Red Energy. As we've told you many times, powered by Snowy Hydro, a leader in renewable energy. Isn't it time you called Red Energy on 131 806?
Gosh, it'd be a bit cold up there in the snowy today, Caro, I reckon.
It would be. And I tell you where else it's cold, and this leads me to my grumpy, the state of Tasmania, after that very underwhelming review put forward by, well, finally revealed, unveiled by the AFL last Friday, but basically unveiled under the cover of COVID. What a topic avoiding, buck passing, hiding behind exercise that has been for the AFL. I am so disappointed in both Colin Carter and the AFL Commission and primarily Gillon McLachlan, who I've always felt had Tasmania in his heart and the potential for a 19th team, and yet has, just to coin a phrase from both Colin Carter, the former Geelong chairman and AFL commissioner who did the review, and the Tasmanian chairman, Tasmanian Premier, I should say, Peter Gutwin, he's just kicked the can down the road again. They have delayed this issue for years. From the time Gillon McLachlan took over in 2014, they have just put Tasmania in the too hard basket. They promised this Colin Carter review in June. They released it in August. Colin Carter didn't even come up with a recommendation. He came up with three choices.
No, I was surprised by that. You said that to me the other day. I was absolutely shocked. What was it all for if you don't come up with recommendations?
Nor a timeline, which was the one thing Tasmania wanted. Now, it's all very well to say the AFL Commission is obsessed with debt reduction, and they are. They are obsessed with getting out of this pandemic, as they should be. But it is just not fair to not give a date. Now, say, make it COVID dependent. Say, you know, we have to grant Tasmania a licence maybe 3 years out of the pandemic, or we will work towards a licence in 2028, assuming COVID is finally beaten in the next 12 months. Something like that, Corrie. But to not even have a date, I think it's just, I thought it was really interesting that your man, Alistair Clarkson, broke ranks with Hawthorn after the game, after that wonderful victory over the Bulldogs on the weekend, and actually said they deserved their own team, when Hawthorn obviously make a lot of money by playing there. So that was a pretty big thing of Alistair Clarkson to say. And as he farewelled Tasmania for the last time as Hawthorn coach, I hope the government of Tasmania stand up to the AFL now and don't sponsor, you know, teams like Hawthorn and North Melbourne to fly in, fly out, and insist on a date and insist on a roadmap, because Colin Carter sadly failed to deliver it.
Wow. Take that, Col.
So I'm grumpy. I'm very grumpy. But for Red Energy, I'm now going to ask you a quick question.
Good.
Should, and there are six of them, so I'll kick off. Should, oh, look, I love this story. Should the Ballarat electorate of Wenderee change its name?
Absolutely not.
To Eureka.
Absolutely not. I don't know where this has begun. And in fact, I rang the Ballarat family yesterday and I said, are you outraged? And look, admittedly, Francesca has three little kids and everything. She said, oh, yeah, so, you know, it's happened. I said, it's happening in your backyard. You need to be engaged. I can't believe this suggestion that Wenderee, which the Ballarat-based electorate of Wenderee, Caro, is an Aboriginal word, as we know. Funnily enough, it is said to mean go away, which is hilarious. Maybe not hilarious. Maybe it was quite poignant at the time. But the Electoral Commission has said that perhaps it should be renamed Eureka in recognition of the 1854 stockade.
I don't mind the name. I don't mind the name Eureka. Yes, oh, Miss Jane's screwing up her nose.
No, you don't take Wenderee. And also, Wenderee is such a significant name in Ballarat and a significant area. Not only is it the lake, but it's a suburb, and of course it's the electorate. I was just outraged. I was outraged. It's like a white fella overlay on a wonderful Indigenous heritage. Nup, Caro, not into it. Really cross. And come on, Ballarat people. Come on, Ballarat family. Get those placards happening. March the streets. Caro, Ernie Sigley died this week, which is very sad. Were you an Ernie Sigley fan?
Well, I was such a fan, Corrie, that when I was hosting the afternoon program on 3AW, and Ernie used to, I actually suggested that he become my sort of fill-in when I took holidays, and he did an absolutely brilliant job and was probably far better at the job than I was. So when I went on maternity leave, from which I never came back, when I became pregnant with Clementine, I actually went in. I remember going in and telling Steve Price, who was running 3AW, look, I'm pregnant and I probably won't come back after I have this third child, because the job with three small children was just going to be too difficult.
You thought you'd become chief footy writer of The Age instead?
Well, that was 2 years later. Yeah, that was pretty crazy. But I said, Ernie's got to do the job. And he went on and, you know, that was his last real job in the media. And, you know, he was a great Tonight Show host in Adelaide. He used to tell great stories about when he was a DJ on that. He was sort of on one of the original, you know, Boat That Rocked, you know, that great film we saw. He worked at Radio Caroline, I think in Germany or somewhere in Europe. Hamburg, maybe, many, many years ago. But, he did a fantastic job, 12 years for his last gig on 3AW. He could be grumpy. He was old-fashioned in his humour. He was a Ballarat boy. Well, in fact, Buninyong was where he spent his last days. I remember his wife, Glenys, one of the most wonderful, gorgeous women, who was very much part of the 3AW family. And, yeah, look, I was a fan. There are not many broadcasters like Ernie anymore who could make it. You know, he was really the little Aussie battler. He adored the Western Bulldogs. Sadly, he was starting to become ill with Alzheimer's when the Bulldogs finally won the flag in 2016. But, yep, that's Ernie. And Corrie, moving on from Ernie Sigley to Barack Obama.
Would you wear versatile in this segment?
We swing around the world. Were you surprised that he didn't invite the Sussexes, sorry, Thea, to his 60th birthday party?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't, Carol.
Were they snubbed?
Well, I don't know. It's hard to get a grip on. It's hard to get a grip on the truth here. What we do know about Barack Obama's 60th birthday party, which was a week or two ago, was that the party originally was going to be 500 and it was scaled back to 200 for COVID reasons. And it was held on Martha's Vineyard and it was turned into a bit of a weekend. There was a golf game. There was a Sunday brunch. I think it was a pretty intense parting time. And look, good on him. Good on him, really, because he's worked so hard for the past 20 or 30 years of his life. He deserves to celebrate. There was a lot of in the American media about whether 200 was even an appropriate number, but they're allowed to have 200 over there. But the guest list, Caro, as I can see, is not overloaded with celebrities, so I don't think the Sussexes should have felt particularly miffed or taken it personally. But history does not relate whether they were perhaps on the first 500 list and then were asked, no, sorry, you can't come. That's embarrassing, isn't it, when you actually have to tell a few people, sorry, you haven't made the second cut?
Well, that's happened a bit in the last year or two in Australia. I mean, I've been asked to a couple of weddings where they've ended up being 20 people, and I've sort of completely understood that I probably wouldn't make the top 20 of some lovely friends. But, no, what I would give to be on Martha's Vineyard at the moment, one of those beautiful big shingled houses, walking down the avenues of, you know, plum, what are they called? Beach plums.
Carol, I'm hanging out for Port Fairy.
Yeah, well, no beach plums at Port Fairy, but lots of beautiful natives.
I don't care where I go. Just get me out of lockdown Melbourne. So one of the joyful things on the weekend, Carol, was seeing the footage of the Field of Dreams. Kevin Costner, as we know, opened the real Field of Dreams over the weekend, but which was just, I had tears in my eyes seeing them play. It was fabulous. What do you reckon his best ever baseball film was?
Well, in my view, it wasn't Field of Dreams. It was one of my favourite sporting films ever, Bull Durham, which also starred Susan Sarandon and Tim Robbins. In fact, I think that's where Susan Sarandon and Tim Robbins first got together in the making of that film. It is a brilliant film. Bull Durham is the Kevin Costner character, an ageing baseballer who comes back to a baseball team. Tim Robbins is the upcoming star. Susan Sarandon is the groupie who, in an opening soliloquy, compares baseball to religion in the most incredible way. It is such a beautifully written film. And your brother Steve will probably disagree with me. I remember him saying to me once that Field of Dreams was the best film ever made, bar none.
Yeah, that's right. And there was a bit of texting going on over the weekend. weekend to brother Steve.
Oh, look, he would have loved that. I mean, and I think it was the highest rating baseball game, bar finals, ever broadcast in America. So it was absolutely beautiful the way they brought, I mean, the whole story of Shoeless Joe Jackson and the Red Sox, the Black Sox was just, is so interesting. I mean, all Eight Men Out is another brilliant film, which I absolutely loved about that topic. But anyway, so Bull Durham, better than Field of Dreams in my view. Corrie, what was your favourite podcast this week, apart from Don't Shoot the Messenger, of course?
Well, I'm about to tell you about a great new podcast, which I think our gang will love, but I just have to insert it on a serious note. This morning, so this is Tuesday that you and I are chatting, Tuesday morning, the New York Times, The Daily, which is a podcast I've spoken about before, dropped an episode. It's just titled The Fall of Afghanistan. And they cross to one Kabul resident to be known only as R, who has worked in the media, and she's one of those wonderful Afghani women who, when the Taliban was defeated, she's been allowed to be educated and have a great career. And she talks about it, they just keep checking in with her over a four-day period. And the increasing fear and trauma in her voice is extraordinary. So that is the New York Times podcast, The Daily, episode August 16. Highly recommend that.
Did you see the vision of all the residents holding onto the plane last
yes.
night?
Oh, yeah, and there are going to be more. And I think, Caro, as I said to my kids in the WhatsApp this morning, you must watch this because that those haunting images of Saigon in 1975 when you and I were teenagers, they still stay with me. And if you can watch these historic moments at the time they happen, I think it's terribly important for our understanding and our empathy and all sorts of reasons to do that. But look, on to a happier note about my podcast tip for the week. A friend of mine, Kathy Lane, said to me a couple of weeks ago that she and her friend Mish Eisner were making a podcast. And would I go on and just do a bit of a chat about book clubs and book club politics, which I did. They've recorded 5 episodes, I think, so far. It's called From the Hip. From the Hip. And you can get it through Spotify, not through Apple iTunes. So go onto Spotify, go into the podcast section, From the Hip. These are two women in their 50s talking about life for women in their 50s. There's a particularly hilarious and interesting episode. Kath, after 18 years of running her own business, has decided that she's going to take a major job with a big PR company in Melbourne. And she talks about, at her age, in late 50s, fronting up for the first day at work at a new gig and how nervous you are. It's so relatable, Caro. Like she had her outfit laid out, then she thought, maybe is that too cool? Is that too corporate? Should I change the high heels? High heel, low heel. It's really funny. But it's a great podcast for, I think there'd be a lovely synergy between our listeners and theirs. So that's From the Hip on Spotify.
And Corrie, I've just added it to my listen list. It's actually on other podcast platforms as well. If people are thinking, haven't got Spotify.
Oh, so Miss Jane, can you tell everybody how they could find it?
Oh, look, I just use your podcast app. I've just used my Pocket Casts, which I love. So I'm pretty sure if you search for it, you'll be able to find it. But I'll put some links in the show notes.
Yeah, it's really good. I mean, one episode they did was health and looking at the whole word well-being. What does that actually mean? As I said, a section on podcasts where I was hilarious. It's not really. Okay, so on to the next question, Caro. Oh, this one, I think I know what you're going to say. Can Q&A on the ABC, can it be saved?
Of course it can be saved. Back to Monday night. I mean, seriously, the worst programming decision ever. But, well, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but it was a really poor decision. It never worked on Thursday night. I loved Hamish. I don't know why he's gone. I mean, that just seemed like I don't know whether it was his decision or the ABC's decision or they just had a massive falling out. But this show is made for Monday night. And, you know, I'm saying this given that it's on against my show, Footy Classified, for 7 or 8 months of the year. But I just can't understand why it was moved to Thursdays. It's a great show. It needs to come back to Monday night.
Hear, hear. And what do you think of three presenters now?
Oh, look, no. No, I don't think that's a good idea either. I'm a one presenter kind of person.
Yeah, I agree.
There's no such thing as a democracy. Anyone who's been in a rock and roll band will tell you that. Not that I ever have been Corrie, it has been wonderful to chat to you again. We will continue to try and brighten up your lives as best we can. Thank you to our podcast supporters for doing that, helping us, Red Energy, 100% Australian electricity and gas, and Prince Wine Store. You can connect with us via Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. And if you want to get our show notes delivered to your inbox each week, and you'll get the recipes and the book recommendations, etc., even an old photo this week of me and Ernie Sigley, hit the sign-up button on Facebook or in our show notes. Thank you, Paige McGinley, my former 3AW producer, for sending me that lovely memory. Or send us an email and we'll subscribe you. Email feedback at don'tshootpod.com.au. And Corrie?
Don't shoot the messenger, Karen.
Hi, it's producer Jane here, and if you've enjoyed the Don't Shoot the Messenger podcast with Caroline Wilson and Corrie Perkin, perhaps you'd like to subscribe to another couple of podcasts proudly supported by Red Energy. Yes, Red Energy also bring you Home Style with Shayna Blaze and Under the Hammer with Stav from O'Brien Real Estate. It's all part of the Red Energy podcast lifestyle series. You can subscribe now wherever you're listening to this podcast. Thanks to Red Energy, most satisfied customers 11 years in a row. That's Red Energy.